Okay, that was April 20th. And note that's Hitler's birthday, April 20th, 1979.
Which is a nice segue into a personal interjection for me, because my birthday, quote-unquote, on this meat sack life, is December 1st, 1979. And the next date is December 2nd, 1979, Walter Boert.
Ah, okay, good. So here it is, 1979. Marshall collapses on September 26th, so he cannot run his Monday seminars, which start about end of September, first of October. So these are free, open to the public Monday seminars that I attended for years. What happens is that Eric runs them through October, November, all right, his son. So, like, December 2nd is a Sunday, so the Monday before that, November 25th or something, I'm at the McLuhan Seminar, and these strangers come in, and a woman and a guy, and they hand out pamphlets. And it turns out they're members of the Church of Scientology, and for some reason they came to this little obscure meeting, we don't know why, we've never seen them before, and they hand out these pamphlets saying that Walter Boert is going to come to Toronto and speak on December 2nd, sponsored by the Church of Scientology. I said, I've been waiting to meet Walter for years and never had an opportunity. Now I can meet him. So on December 2nd, I go to the OISE, which is the Ontario Institute of Studies and Education, a upstart semi-university kind of thing on Bloor Street. And what do you think of OISE, Carolyn, when you hear of OISE? You think of New Age seminars happening there?
Second rate.
B-grade academia or something. So I go in there, noon hour. It's going to be a long slide lecture by Walter on MKUltra and the whole history of everything, sort of Mae Brussels kind of material. And there's this tall, handsome guy standing there talking to people. I immediately recognize him because I've seen pictures of him years ago. So I introduce myself to him, and he looks down at me. I'm quite shorter than him. He's smugly looking at me, and I don't know what transpired right now, but he said, well, let's talk after the lecture. I don't know what I said to him. He talks about that. I said something to him, and he got intrigued. So I watched the lecture, which was very good slides and everything. And then after the lecture, we met, and we went back to his room, which was a hotel room, and we probably talked for about 8 hours because we had a lot to talk about. So we became instant friends, and then the next day he was on a local TV show, Joyce Davidson, the wife of David Susskind, who was the famous American talk show guy, David Susskind of New York City. But she, his wife, ran a talk show in Toronto. She was a Canadian. So Walter does the TV show, and then we spend the week together, and that was the beginning of my big relationship with Walter Boert. And within a few months, in April, we go out to be at his big mansion in Aspen, Colorado, that he had acquired with Peggy Hitchcock Mellon, who
Michael asked me that the other day. Peggy Mellon is Peggy Hitchcock? No.
Yeah, Peggy Hitchcock.
Yes.
There's the Mellon, many Mellon families. One of them is the Hitchcock, because the main Mellon daughter married a Hitchcock, who was a war hero, and put a Rolls-Royce motor in an American airplane that did really well in World War II. And he died testing one of them, 1944. That was Peggy Hitchcock's father. She remembers as a girl, born in 1933, Sarnoff, the head of RCA Victor, brought a TV to their home like in 1941 or 42, before anybody had one. And they had a TV there in the early 40s because they were wealthy and Sarnoff was part of their class. David Sarnoff is a guy that McLuhan criticizes and makes fun of in Understanding Media. So they were the American establishment, and so she was Peggy Hitchcock. But you have to say she's a Mellon to point out the wealth world she comes from. So she and Walter had divorced by 1980 when we went out to visit him in Aspen, Colorado. So that's December 2nd. Okay, so what happened is that I invited him to Eric's Monday night seminar, and he'd wanted to meet Eric since 1968. He thought, McLuhan must have a son. Let me do business with him, start some publication, because I'm leaving the East Village other. Well, he never knew that Eric was in New York City, and never met him and blah, blah, blah. So I'm filling him in all these coincidental details that he didn't know that shows how close he came to getting what he wanted. But now he could, so he could come and meet Eric. We go over to the seminar place at the Cocho's, and I introduce him to Eric, and I ask Walter if he could speak, and he said, sure. Eric does his talk first, It's about subliminal seduction in Wilson Brian Key's book, which McLuhan had written a foreword to, Subliminal Stuff in Advertising, a book that made McLuhan regret sort of writing later about it. But Eric did this, and he went on and on and on, and someone said, wait a minute, look at this guy here, Walter guy. Sounds interesting. Let's hear him, Eric. We've got your point. Can you stop your talk? So Eric stopped his talk, and Walter got up and spoke about his research in MKUltra and CIA. And that was very good, and everybody liked it. And then the meeting was over. That turned out to be the last meeting at the seminar because the university started to close down the thing and nothing was done in 1980. And then the coach house was closed in June 1980. So Walter was the last speaker at the famous McLuhan seminars, or open to the public seminars. That's the significant, one of the significance of December 2nd, 1979.
So he wanted to meet Eric, but had he met Marshall?
No, he never met Marshall. He was too slack on studying Marshall. He kind of liked it, knew a bit about it. He made the stupid notion of, oh, I don't want to deal with Marshall. I'll deal with his son. He should have just gone to Marshall, and then he would have met his son. It would have been interesting. And Eric was living in New York City right at that time in 1968, editing the Dooline newsletter. So Bowert missed McLuhan, but he wasn't meant to know about McLuhan unless until he met me. So that's how he got into McLuhan, was through me in detail and found out what Marshall was really about. So next day.
Okay. So then it's Joe Dunsloan in April 1980.
We visit Bowert in like April 22nd, 1980 in Aspen. Then we go to L.A. And that's when Carol and I were with Joe. We stayed at Joe's probably. And that's when he showed me the experiments done by the Ames Research Lab, the documented photographs of how they tested the D-cell in 76, 77, even newspaper articles in the L.A. Times about the report and how the D-cell made this muddy water pool that they're funding, muddy water going through a pool, and they put the D-cell over the hose that the water passes through, and after a couple of weeks, the water was all clear just by running over a D-cell rock. So there was this proof, and Joe says either then, 1980, or a little later, that he thinks that they took what they thought they could, because he wouldn't give them the formula, but they tried to figure out something, and they made interferon from their bastardization of what the D-cell was made of. That was his theory. I don't know if it was true. But that was significant to see the lab results showing that the D-cell could do pretty interesting stuff. That's April 28th, 1980.
Oh, then the next one is May Brussel, July 29th, 1980.
That's when I made contact with May Brussel. I read an article in We Magazine, maybe, on her. May 1978, I found it in a secondhand bookstore in July 1980. It's all about May, and I said, I gotta meet this lady. So I called her up on that day. That's how we got started.
So when you called her up, how did she react?
Well, I didn't know who she was or what would happen, so I was just very careful in what I said, and we just started talking, and I expressed an interest in her information, and she said she had a tape series, that she wasn't doing her radio show. See, she stopped doing her radio show from 78 to 80 for that two-year period, maybe the middle of 80, because she had death threats in 78, so decided to get off the air, and that was a dangerous time. You can read Beater's stuff on 78, 79. That's when the Rockefellers were killed off. A lot of fighting happening because the Bolsheviks came to America and started killing everybody. So she was smart to get off the air. But when Reagan was running for president in 1980, she couldn't take it anymore. She had predicted Reagan would become president back in that Yoko Ono, John Lennon-funded article in 1972. So now her prediction was coming true. He was running for president, so she knew all hell was going to break out. So she said, fuck this. I don't care if I got death threats. I'm going on the radio. So she either told me that, and I started getting her radio broadcasts at that point, getting cassettes. I found out about the weekly cassettes. And then over the next years, I started talking more and more, well, liking her personality. So we ended up having equally good sense of humor. So that's how we bonded, through the sense of humor at first. Because she was very suspicious of everybody. She was suspicious of me, and had to be careful at first talking to her.
I think I've heard you say before that you got to spend time with her right before she passed.
So we were there the day she died. And she died later. We were with her. We were probably the last outsiders to meet her. Her family was around her. We spoke to her. And then a couple hours later, she died. And we were standing outside when that was happening. So then we met everybody through the funeral and everything, Dave Emery and everybody. So that was really good. So we had a great couple of days there meeting people through the funeral. And that's how I got to meet her daughters, Cayenne especially, who I'm in touch with lately. So, yes, with Mae Brussel, after a while, we became friends. And then she called me up in 1983 and said her friend Lydia Blades, who had they done research for years together and would go around to used bookstores and libraries and used book sales, gathered up a whole library. Both of them built a library each. Lydia Blades just died, and Mae wondered if I'd be interested in buying her library, which I did, and I got that in January 84. And if you look at that interview with me in Toronto with Daniel Libby and Linus Minimax, that's up there, me with the purple shirt, long interview, I explained that I was able to get Bob Marshall on CKLN because John Jones came over to check me out, and I showed him my library, which I just acquired 6 months before, had not read any of it, but I didn't tell him that. I look like a heavy researcher. And he accepted Bob Marshall by associating with me, was allowed to start putting Mae Brussel on the air or doing something with Mae Brussel. So that's what happened. By the second half of 84, we're doing this whole radio thing, which we have no inkling of that in January 84 when the library shows up. But the library is the effects preceding the causes. It's coming for a certain reason.
Then the next day is August 8th, 1981. Yes, that's what I was going to say. That was a Bukowski date as well.
Yes, this, it's also J.W.'s birthday. His date gets in there twice. I never realized that before. I mean, I don't think there's anybody else's date is repeated. But August 8th is repeated in 76 and 1981. What's that, Sherman Skolnick?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about Sherman Skolnick, but Mae Brussel turned me on to Skolnick at some point in probably the summer of 81. She was a good friend of his, and he had these, you could phone in this phone system in Chicago, and you could hear messages, newsworthy messages he put on his phone answering machine. So I thought that was really neat, so I called him on that date, and we became friends. And I started playing, I got Bob Marshall to play recordings of his funny or newsworthy telephone messages. We played that on CKLN starting in August 84.
Are you telling me that he had, an answering machine that he would change the message with new and important information?
Yeah, for its time, it was way ahead of everybody. You could call in and hear a message, and he would have a five-minute newsworthy making connections like Mae Brussel, and then he'd have another message, which would be a joke. He'd make a skit up. And, I have those.
Wow. It's kind of the original Facebook selfie right there.
Yeah.
That is. That's revolutionary.
So Skolnick was a great guy, and I met him through May.
Okay.
So that's August 8th, 81.
Then November 18th, 1981, is Ian Arlett?
Now, I've just posted about Ian the other day. Somebody maybe on the chat line pointed out Ian's the guy who came up with the 22 pattern. The Canadian poet. Mm-hmm. And I posted a video of him. You can see him in action in 1982. It's right when this date. But November 18th, 81. November 18th?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Wyndham Lewis' birthday. So we went to a conference in Toronto. I think Gene Youngblood, who did Expanded Cinema, was there. And maybe Barry Nevitt spoke. This is after McLuhan died in the last day of 1980. So we're now a year later. Oh, November 18th, 81, that's when I got the nod to do McLuhan's archives. Mark Stewart and Barry Nevitt told Ms. McLuhan, get Bob if you want to organize Marshall's papers. As nobody knows Marshall as much as Bob. Get him to organize it. So I'm telling Ian on November 18th, 1981, that I got this gig doing Marshall's papers. Wow, I get to see whatever I thought I would find there. You remember that place down by the Art College Carroll, the Grange, and they had little mall there. We were sitting there. It was a conference, and we were just eating in a cheap place, cheap Subway place or something. And I'm telling you, and Ian freaked out. Maybe he got jealous. He got very mad at me for some stupid reason and stormed out.
When you just said it right there, it kind of sounded like people were vying for that position to be the one to go
through
it.
No, nobody knew about it. I didn't know it. Nobody knew that. They didn't know anything. Nobody knew. Jeez, they were all sad that Marshall died, but I don't think they were thinking, oh, I'm going to be the guy to do the papers. I don't think anybody, because I wasn't thinking about it. We didn't know what papers there were, and I was surprised they called me up and nominated me. I know I started working the last week, you know, the 22nd, 23rd of November is when I started doing it. We went to a bank building, and the top floor where all the filing cabinets were, where all the letters were in the filing cabinets. They wouldn't let me look at the letters, but I had organized all the boxes. There were about 60 cardboard boxes with papers and files all just scrambly dumped in there. And they might have been messy because some of them were at the coach house, and that was emptied out messily by people who didn't care about Marshall's work. So maybe that's why it was all mixed up. But I was the only one who would know, okay, here's an article. I can tell the style of writing. This would have been written in the 40s. So then I put it in a 1940s file. I could figure out what years they would go to, what decades. So Mrs. McLuhan and their agent, Mady Molinaro, you can read about them in the letters of McLuhan. They get credits for putting that together with William Toy, who was a good friend of Dave Neufeld's father. And we know a little bit about behind the scenes of him writing that book with Mady and Corinne McLuhan and Mady Molinaro. So I'm telling Ian about this, and he has a tantrum and walks out. And I don't see him for 3 years.
But you are not sure why, or you know it's because of that?
I think he was jealous. He was always slightly jealous. I mean, years later, he's sitting in our nice home in the late 80s. He brought a friend over and introduced him to me, but he's sitting there with his friend. He looks at me and goes, "You fucking lucky bastard. You fucking lucky bastard." He's sort of saying this at me as we're sitting in our beautiful house, and he's living in a dingy place, you know. He's always semi-homeless. He made the mistake of going back to university and getting in huge debt. So you can go on Dupes and look at the video of him. That video is about 81, 82. That's right when he got mad at me. He went to Ottawa and lived there for a few years. And then he got back in touch with me somehow, and then we became, quote, friends again. But he's someone I knew, and he came from Toronto and lived in Halifax in that 70s period. He was part of the people, and stories aren't made about him, but he's part of the stories in the Toronto section of the diary. One of them is named Ian. I think I make Nelson Ian, and I make Ian Nelson, totally opposites. Anyways, that's what happened on November 18th, 81. Significant encounter with Ian, you know.
You think you made Nelson Ian and Ian Nelson, but can't be sure about that.
Well, I have to check it. I switched the names, but I think that's what I would have done because Nelson is a, you know, rich kid, and Ian's a homeless poet from Burlington. And I have Ian here. If he ever read the diaries, he'd be reading himself as Nelson, which was a joke I did on him. And Nelson never wanted to be like Ian.
That's what I wanted to interject. You do this to make an intimate joke with the person that it's done to.
Yeah, it's an insider
to them. It's not to confuse people or to code things. It's just to kind of let them be in on it.
It's a personal joke only they'd get because it doesn't matter to you that he's named Ian or Nelson. It doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely, but it could matter to me in a paranoid way where I could just all day long try to decode it. And
try to figure out who, I'm actually frustrating you. That's a good point. I'm making a joke for you guys because you're going to have to eventually decode it and realize, oh, this is the other guy. He switched the name. Like James Kidney is in there, I think, the guy who ends up on Fringe. He's one of the names in there. So look at the video of Ian on Dupes. It's sort of him in his prime. He does a poem or two. Oh, yeah, so I found out in Toronto in September when I was there, that he died in April 2012. I did not know that he had died out in British Columbia. So Ian's the one who came up with the number, noticing the 22 in the news. So here's a follow-up that. Here's what happened. I tell him I'm doing the McLuhan Archives. It's when I'm doing the McLuhan Archives I notice I'm in box 22. So then I tell Ian that, which would have been in December 81. And then, unbeknownst to me, he starts making a notebook, noticing 22 everywhere. And he comes back to me like in June 82 and shows me this book, little notebook of his poet's notebook. And he says, here, you have this. I can't take it anymore. 22 shows up everywhere. And I'm going, what? So he noticed the 22 pattern after I kind of noticed it just within me, but he noticed it out in the world. And now the McLuhan seminar started up again somewhere around then. And that's when he had
the Hebrews knew a little bit about that a long time before that.
Oh, yeah. But, no, we're just noticing it in the Android meme, in the media. So sometime after that, he got mad. He did have a tantrum in 1981, and then he had another tantrum in 82, and that's when he left for Ottawa. So maybe, I know he got mad at, but he wasn't mad enough to not speak to me, but he got real mad in 82. Over something that happened at the new McLuhan seminars, the new ones that were put on by Eric and Derek de Kirchhoff and David O'Driscoll. That's, we have a correction there. He couldn't have run away in November 81 because that's when I'm doing the McLuhan thing, and I tell him. So he hears about Box 22, deals with it for six months. Maybe that's part of why he ran away. I'm just thinking now, the 22 pattern that I first mentioned to him slightly, it could have freaked him out, and he didn't want to deal with my scene because the 22 thing freaked him out. So that may be another reason why he ran off to Ottawa. And he comes back 2 years later. And you will hear Ian on the famous, you know, when I get elected Secret Council 10 on March 3rd, 1988, on Mike Dyer's afternoon show, and we're screaming, yelling. Ian's there. He's my bodyguard. You'll hear Ian laughing, yelling in the background. Ian used to come to the CKLN with me in June 87 till April 20th, Hitler's birthday, 88, including the debate with Reverend Stang on April 13th, 1988. That's on the timeline. Ian was the guy who was my bodyguard. So you can hear him in the background making commentary occasionally. He came back in 1984, and that's when we got on the radio, and so he monitored from that point on the whole CKLN thing with Bob Marshall.
Okay, so by bodyguard, do you also mean monitor?
I mean, it's a joke. We called him my bodyguard. He wasn't my bodyguard, no. Literally, but he was big and beefy, and he looked like one. And he could intimidate little punks at CKLN, so he was considered my bodyguard.
Okay. The next one is Paul Shockley, and it's April 3rd, 1982.
April 3rd, 1982. Carol and I go up and visit Walter Boward in Port Townsend, Washington State. And while there, we drive down to Portland, Oregon to meet Paul Shockley, who I had met in Seattle in 69-70. He now become the new medium for cosmic awareness, so I wanted to check him out because we looked a bit askance at what his mediumship was as opposed to Dave Worser's channeling of cosmic awareness. So Walter and I drove down to see Paul Shockley in Oregon, and we had some interesting things happen that day. Walter got this big insight that there had been studies on people, and you trigger the eureka part of your brain, the brain that gets insights. He was telling me and Paul Shockley that they just discovered that people prefer that insight, the insight, eureka sensation, more than orgasm.
That's
the
great.
Mental orgasm was a stronger thing than the sexual orgasm among these people who had the mental orgasm stimulated.
Wow.
So we were talking about that day at Paul Shockley's home. Dee Dee Farrell was there, who she just posted the other day. She's the one who distributed the D-cell in the 80s. There was a guy there we met, and I think we went back to his apartment in Seattle on the way back. So anyways, driving down, I was trying to get Walter interested in Dr. Beter. So we were listening to the Dr. Beter tapes on the truck tape machine, and a couple times we almost died because Boward kept falling asleep listening to Beter and driving off the road and hitting a rail or something. So it was amazing we made it through that. So I stopped playing the Beter tapes after a while because he was only falling asleep. He said, this guy makes me fall asleep.
That's the next person. It's Dr. Beter. It's April 22nd of that same year, 1982. This is pretty funny how you're basically going into the next person each time.
Right, that's a good point. I have forgotten that. Now, I know Beter for years, but this is the big, in January 25th, 1982, Al Haig became Secretary of State. Remember, he had announced he was in charge after Reagan was shot on March 31st or something, 1981, so like about a year before. And Dr. Beter's tapes reported that Haig represented the Rockefeller guys trying to fend off the Bolsheviks who'd taken over the Pentagon. So Haig was in a weak position. That's why when Reagan got shot, he tried to take advantage of him, said, "I'm in charge," and exploit him, and he probably didn't get far. So he got really pissed off. By on January 25th, 82, he said, "We got a real problem. We got nuclear war." He panicked, and he made this press conference on that date. Dr. Beter, on April 22nd, which is one of the most important dates, we met and talked about the crisis that was coming, and that's when Beter said, according to his source of information, definitely there was going to be a nuclear war attempt in September 82. So that was an important conversation leading up to us intervening on September 17th in 82. So you can go and read Beter's transcripts of the recordings he made in 1982, because he's going to quit in November 82. So this is his final year of doing these recordings, which he'd been doing for 7 years. So it's a big year for Beter, and very dramatic. Okay, next date.
The next one is June 23rd, 1982.
Barry Nevitt?
Yep.
I remember that, yeah. So on that day, June 23rd, 1982, I go visit him. He's like the main guy to talk to after Marshall died in early 81. On that day is when I went with Barry, and he appreciated my understanding of McLuhan, and he named me his archivist. And then I started collecting up all the stuff, and I just was looking through. I have the unpublished part of Take the Day of the Executive's Dropout, where they take the 10 Thunders of Finnegan's Wake and lay out advice to management based on the 10 Thunders. It's an incredible thing. I have that manuscript because I became his archivist. I got a lot of valuable stuff from him.
Then June 15th, 1983, is Nelson Thal.
That's the day we met. Well, we actually met in early 83. He and Barry Nevitt started to do the McLuhan Monday Night Seminars, open to the public, that McLuhan used to do. The coach house was shut down for a couple of years, and it got reopened in early 83. Nelson and I went and saw de Kerckhoff, who was sort of in charge with David Driscoll of the coach house, and we asked if we could start the Monday night things up. And we said we got Barry Nevitt, who had cachet there, clout, and Barry would be part of it. That's in May 83. What happened?
June.
Now, what happened? Oh, wait. The seminar started. No, I didn't know Nelson, so I didn't organize that. I didn't do that. I'm thinking of a later thing. So Nelson and Barry Nevitt organized the seminars starting in April, May. So I went to them, and on April 25th, 1983, George Thompson, McLuhan's assistant, who was a good friend of Nelson, introduced me to Nelson. He said, you two, I think, should meet. So I met him, and nothing came of that. And that was a group panel organized by other people. But we met there, and then in May, Barry and Nelson started their Monday night thing. So I went to them, and after one of them, middle of May, I was talking to an older journalist whose wife was a patient of Carolyn's. And he was talking about the Center of Investigative Reporting. He was complaining that investigative reporting had disappeared and journalism couldn't be done the way he liked to do it. So we were talking about media, news, and journalism. And I started telling about my bustle, Skolnick and everybody. I said, there's the real journalism. Why don't you get turned on to that? You know, start doing this. And this guy was a bit of a phony, and I knew he probably wouldn't do anything. But anyways, I'm going on about May Brussels and the Kennedy assassination and all this stuff. I'm not saying I was involved in the Kennedy assassination at that point. I wasn't saying stuff like that to nobody. Anyways, I'm talking to this guy and saying a lot. And then the meeting dispersed, because this was a talking after the formal discussion. The meeting dispersed, and Nelson came up to me and says, "I heard you talking about May Brussel. I know about May Brussel and Kennedy assassination. I didn't know you knew this stuff." And I said, "Oh, yeah." So he said, "We got to get together." So we arranged to meet at my place on June 15th, 1983. So he came over, and he was flabbergasted at what I could teach him about McLuhan, but also since he had done research in the Kennedy assassination on his own for years, and he actually went to the conference in Boston in 1975, which featured May Brussel and Skolnick, among other people, but Nelson was too young to connect with them, but he vaguely remembered them there, but he didn't know anything. If he was born in 1952, so he was 22 when he went to that conference, there's a significant date for him. But he was amazed that I had all this stuff to say about Mae Brussels. So we got together and talked what we would call bottom-up stuff. That's McLuhan. That's people-generated reality. And then the top-down is the bureaucratic control of society by whoever elites pretend to be bureaucracy. That can go from church to government or military. That's top-down. So he never had a chance to talk bottom-up and top-down with McLuhan topics with anybody. And then when he found out that I had talked to McLuhan about that stuff, he said, man, I should have talked to Marshall about, I didn't know Marshall was into the Kennedy assassination and that stuff. So that was the beginning of our friendship, June 15th, 1983.
Did you have your charts?
Well, what happened is he and Bob Marshall made the first chart in 1985 on April 22nd. And you can see that at fivebody.com. They took my stuff and made a top-down and a bottom-up chart.
And you said something in Cambridge about a black and white kind of flip happening with that.
They flip back and forth because the word becomes a market. So the bureaucracy then becomes the authority in the media, and whoever controls the microphone at the White House determines what reality is. They determine whether contact is made with aliens or not, or whether there's such a thing as the iCell. That's the Android meme. That's where the content becomes the form. The content and form merge.
That's
so the medium and the message merge. Because the new technology
the
is speech itself. What'd you say?
That's why I'm visually picturing it as like a receding black kind of phasing in and out of a white.
That's Ion saying it's not whether it's right or wrong or who's right or wrong. It's who is to be blamed.
Or and who's got the loudest voice.
Yeah. Who's got the microphone to blame everybody. So it's important to understand that the software global theater merges and merges and holopathizes and shrinks to, in the end, the technology that runs the world is speech from the White House. That's the focal human scale of the Android meme. Comes down to a little global membrane. Not a global village or global theater, but a global membrane. And the center, the communication of that radiates from what's called the White House. So, okay, so that's what date? June 15th, 1983, we finished that.
Mm-hmm. Then September 10th, 1983 is, woo-woo, little thrill, David E. Worcester.
Thrill squared
is what I like to say now.
Yeah, that's when he's living out in Lake Elsinore in California. You know, you can hear in Furry Lint, he's talking to me about interesting place where all the elites live in Lake Elsinore, and he's living out there.
Michael played a clip for me once of him playing piano. Where is he for that?
That's the day before the Zappa interview. That's October 20th, 1988, in a small bar in Venice Beach, where I wanted to interview Dave. And we do that, and Jerry and Dave knew the bar and organized it, and we got someone to videotape that. And then the next day, we get word that we can do Zappa. So maybe David Worcester was 2 days before, October 19th, and then we hear about Zappa on the 20th, then we bring Bob Marshall in on the 21st, and then the interview's done Friday night, the 21st into the 22nd. But that's 1988. Back in September 83, I would not be in Dave's presence. I must have had a very important phone call with him when he was in Lake Elsinore, and a lot of talk about whatever. And some of that got recorded then or later, and it's on Furry Lint. And the kind of conversation on Furry Lint is typical of what Dave would talk about, because the one on Furry Lint is January 86, where Dave says he's going to make 4 chess moves and somebody's going to lose $40 billion because someone stole his dog, and that led to the space shuttle Challenger goes up on like January 26 or something,
click,
or 28.
Click.
So I'm not sure. That's a phone conversation with Dave, and nothing sticks in my mind about what was significant about that. Maybe I was telling him about Larry Flint and Rebel Magazine. Because Rebel Magazine starts then, and Mae Brussels got a big role in it.
Larry Flint, is that another magazine that he had?
Yeah, as he was running for president, he wanted to create an alternative journalism to go against Time. And that's after he met Mae Brussel, and it's after the KAL-009 has crashed in the Korean Airlines in September 1st, October, August 31st or something, 1983. And then Mae calls up Flint. She didn't know him and told him what it really meant. He's flabbergasted what she knows. So he says, I'm going to make a magazine around it, around you. You're going to be the focal point. And shortly after, Mark Cooper and some people came in, maybe even G. Gordon Liddy came in and convinced Flint to not rely on Mae so much. So that doomed the magazine, and it only went about 8 issues. Then they arrested Flint. He was put in a mental asylum in Rochester, I think.
He also started Transworld.
What's that?
Transworld is a skateboard magazine. He started that in 83, too, I think. Wait, yeah, founded in 1983.
Yeah, what happened is that he put out a Kennedy expose in the L.A. Free Press in 1978. As a result of that, he was shot, paralyzed from the waist down, and he was in agony because his nerves were damaged for 5 years. He finally had an operation in 83 that severed the pain nerve, but he lost his sexual function. That was the sacrifice. So he now could function. Now he's pissed off at what Reagan had done to America. Then the KAL 007 goes down, and he's suspicious of that, and he puts a big ad in the newspapers in the first week of September 83 saying, let's question this. It's not what Reagan says it is. And unbeknownst to me, Frank Zappa was working on the big spread on him being in Hustler magazine in the April 84 issue. So Frank walks in, sees this big newspaper ad thing that Larry's working on, gives him advice on how to tweak it. So Frank gets involved with Larry Flint, and Frank's not aware of Mae Brussel. That's right. The ad went out. Mae liked the ad, called him up, told him even more stuff about Congressman Larry McDonald, who would have been J.W.'s congressman out of Atlanta, Georgia. But J.W. would have only been, 17 years old then, 18 years old. I had to ask J.W. about Larry McDonald. He was the main Cold Warrior guy. So he's on KL-007, and he dies. And Mae calls up Larry Flint and says, the gang around Larry McDonald, congressman, whatever he was, senator, probably were the people who shot you in 1978. So she kind of fills in details, and that floors Larry Flint about how he got shot. Mae knows these things. And then they create Rebel Magazine. Mae Brussel does Rebel Magazine. Then I turn Frank on to, what's the last date in 84? Is it August 84?
The next one is December 29th, 83, Garrett Dean. And then the very last one is August 14th, 84.
Yes, that relates to this. You can hear my phone conversations I recorded with Garrett Dean on Furry Lint. He's very funny, and it's really good stuff. He says he's the Jimmy Joyce, or I'm saying he's the Jimmy Joyce of Dartmouth. That was recorded on December 29th, 83. So anyways, and that's listed. He's Holy Office number 9, the personal mentor. So that's important because I recorded him and got him doing good stuff so people could hear it. Then the next date is August 14th, 1984. That's when Harry Greenbaum, my Zappa connection in New York City, who would send me all the bootlegs, he calls me up and says, it's like in the afternoon, he will be at the Limelight on 6th Avenue and West 20th tonight at the club. You got to be here. The building is a church that was where Thompson ran Lindisfarne in the 70s, right there on the corner of 6th Avenue and West 20th Street. I don't think I knew what the Limelight was till I got there. Thompson writes about this, how what was a very sacred thing with Gregory Bates and all these mystical New Age thinkers there in the 70s became a raging disco in the 80s run by a Canadian, and they got busted in the 90s, and that led to that famous murder, that kid murdered the other kid. You might have heard those guys of your generation.
What?
Michael somebody.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That happened in Thompson's old haunts. So he was saying that was a metaphor of what happened to America after Reagan came in. They wiped out the eco-fascist stuff that Thompson was running in a nice meditative church there, and then it became a raving disco with a murder in it. 10 years later.
They're trying to, it would be like a underground party, rave, and then they're trying to initiate something in a place that was once holy. They're trying to
doing the modern initiation through
to create a ritual,
culture. Yeah.
Wow.
And it was run by a Canadian guy. And Thompson had abandoned the United States in the late 60s and went to Canada and taught there before he came back with his new commune, Lindisfarne idea. So Thompson had a Canadian connection too. Okay, so Greenbaum tells me this like at 4 in the afternoon or something. So I grabbed my passport. I said, Carol, I'm running to the airport. I got to get down there, get a plane. There was a plane from Toronto, New York. So I get out to the airport in good time, get in the airplane. I don't even have hardly any money with me. I don't know why. I bought a real quick ticket. And I sit there on the tarmac for an hour and a half because it's stormy and the plane can't fly. So I end up eventually getting to the limelight at 11:30 at night. I was hoping to get there by 9. So I get in there, and I find Henry, and he says, Frank is holding court at the back. So I go back and watch Frank talking to people. The disco is dancing away. I think most people don't even know Frank's there, don't care, because it's like the next generation. So at a certain point, no one is talking to Frank, so I make myself visible to Frank, and, you know, we've known each other for a long time. So we get right into it. I'm telling him about Rebel Magazine and Mae Brussel, my version of the story. I didn't know he was involved in the story. He has his spread in the April 84 Hustler, and now this is August. It's almost a year later, you know, from September 83 to August 84, and I'm telling him all about what happened to Larry Flynt because he somehow connected Flynt because he's in the magazine. So I tell him about how he got arrested and he's in a mental institute and Mae Brussel was the cause of it, blah, blah, blah. And he only dimly gets this. He was aware of what happened to Larry. He knew he ran for president, but he didn't know the Mae Brussel level. So I said, you've got to hear Mae Brussel's recordings. That's where we organized that I would send him the recordings. And he gave me his agent, Jane Friedman, in New York. I think that was her name. So that's August 14th, 84. That was a great night. I'm glad I made it there to make that connection because he then performs, and he's on tour. He's performing around this time, the summer of 84. He always performs in election year, you know, stirs up the pot. So he performs in Toronto 2 weeks later. I see him there in Toronto. And then he comes to Halifax, Nova Scotia, November 6th, the day of the election when Reagan gets in for a second term, November 6th, 84, and Sue Bone and the Club 22 people in Halifax, they're now going to get to see Frank in their hometown, so they say, I got to be there, so they fly me down there. I didn't need the money, but they just make it sort of generous or just to make sure I get there. I think we have pictures posted on Dupes where we take Garrett and Sue Bone and Art McKay and Greg Skinner. Greg Skinner's the guy with Harry Whittier who met me in New York City when I was dancing to the rock and roll in 1975, in April 75. And that was the Ken Kesey story and Paul Krasner. So we get to see Frank in Halifax the next day, and we've heard Sue tell the story. We drive downtown to go to the mall at Scotia Square. She goes in there, and she comes back and walking back out with a guy. I says, holy shit, Sue picked up another fucking guy I got to deal with. She's always picking up guys or just friendly being with people and always bringing new people that I want to deal with. So the guy gets in the car, and as he sits in the car, I recognize him. Wait a minute, who's this guy? And I realize, oh, it's Alan Zavod, the guy who played piano for Zappa the night before. So I said, where's Frank staying at? And he said, the Citadel Inn. So he says he'll take us up to Citadel Inn. And so I meet John Smothers, the bodyguard, and I explain that I have the Mae Brussel tapes and I need to talk to Frank to see what he thought of them. So he goes in and comes back out and says, yes, Frank's having dinner. He'll be out in a few minutes. So Frank comes out, and we sit there for half an hour, 45 minutes, talking about the Mae Brussel tapes. And Sue gets a photograph of me and Frank. It's the only photograph of me and him together. So anyways, the point is that the September 21st, 83, I am telling Dave Wurster about Larry Flynt and Mae Brussel, and I don't know Zappa is involved with Larry Flynt and is involved with the thing that the ad about KL that draws Mae into Flynt's world, creates Rebel Magazine, that runs 8 issues, and then Flynt is busted. And then the editorial policy changed at Hustler slightly, so there was a coup maybe at Hustler. So no, here it is, okay. A year later, August 14th, I'm telling him to do the Mae Brussel thing, and then he says, well, I know a bit about the Larry thing because I helped him make the ad. And that was amazing to me. That's August 14th. So then November 7th, I'm with them, and we talk about the recordings. And then a year later, say September 85, Frank calls up Mae Brussel and says, I'm going to go testify against the rock censorship lyric stuff. Give me the dirt on the guys who are going to be on the Senate panel. So she does. So then she calls me, tells me, Frank just called me, and I knew it was because of you. She appreciated that. And then shortly after that, Frank gave her a computer. That would get into 86, and I don't think she ever did anything with it. And then she died 2 years later. So there's the full story of the dates.
So that's basically the end, Bob. That is the end of the list.
What is said after the second list? What comes after that?
Okay. August 28th, 1984, Bob Marshall made his first broadcast of the International Connection on CKLN-FM 88.1.
Right. That, oh, there it is. Yeah, so that's August 14th, 1984, with Zappa at the Limelight. And then, 2 weeks later, the 28th, Bob Marshall makes
his first
broadcast.
Yeah, so we're going, the dates here on my left page is phase one. The second list is intro to phase two. And then the Bob Marshall broadcast is phase three, it says, beginning phase three.
I probably told Frank about the fact I got someone to go on the radio and all that, and we were going to play Mae Brussel tapes. That would have been known by then. So I probably told him that on August 14th, too, that we were going to be broadcasting Mae Brussel stuff. But he didn't know anything about Mae at that point. And so you get the second list, and it's his phase three, and then I just say that date, and then there's nothing more?
Oh, no, there's plenty. Okay. This was the beginning of phase three. Connie and I privately referred to this act as Who's Forgotten Furry Lent. Bob Marshall was Bobby Dean's new role as a journalist and broadcaster. For the next 3 years, Marshall was a figure to prepare the ground for the unveiling of me and my awesome mission. Phase four. Bobby Dean, with the assistance of his friend Art McKay, had quietly rehearsed this new public visibility by giving a lecture on the work of Marshall McLuhan to a small class in Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax on January 6, 1984.
That's me giving Prince Charles disinformation. Bobby Dean is long dead and a big secret, a murder that we do not want to be exposed, and we're waiting for people to look at the Guffey thing to notice what happened there, Guffey being part two on The Matrix. So I'm now pretending to, what's his name, Prince Charles, that Bobby Dean is still around or something.
Well, and that's phase four, the mystery phase.
Yeah, I totally forgot I wrote that stuff. It doesn't even make sense. But then I make a little pattern.
Ooh.
Okay, keep reading.
With the footnote, I love that little pattern. But,
yeah,
okay, as you well know.
I actually say it's all about me. I say that to him, Prince Charles.
Pretty much constantly, but yes.
No, you said I go, and then phase four, which is about me.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're always jabbing at him like that, but here on page 125, you go ahead and say, for the next 3 years, Marshall was the figure to prepare the ground for the unveiling of me and my awesome mission. Yeah.
Right. Now, I never would have said that to him before that, but here it is after 1990, after C Council 10, and I've disbanded it. And I'm gloating at him, telling him what he didn't know. That's why I'm saying that right then. I would never have said that before. Not until the results were in.
As you well know, Charles, in January of 1987, I met with your representatives in London to arrange your purchase of a large quantity of gold bullion.
This is the gold
After
deal
that.
With Hugh Sims Hildage. You know, I've talked about the gold deal with Bitter and Hugh Sims Hildage, the representative of the Queen. That's what that's about.
Okay. After that, we were ready. This is great. We duped Adam Vaughn, the manager of CKLN at the time, by having Bob Marshall replay some audio tapes by Peter Beter, which Vaughn had forbidden. Bob Marshall was fired. Mike Dyer was upset. Mike invited Bob onto his show at the same station. I now had a disincarnate form to stage my campaign for chairmanship of the Secret Council of Ten. It was June 17, 1987, in the middle of the Iran-Contra hearings, and 2 months to the day before the Harmonic Bob Virgins. The world began to feel the effects of decades of planning as momentous change became obvious to everyone. A footnote. To illustrate how the forgotten details in people's lives resonate and are often prophetic, consider these facts. 1. Carolyn Wheeler had a boyfriend before she met Bobby Dean. His name was Bob Dyer. 2. Bobby Dean had a girlfriend before he met Carolyn Wheeler. Her name was Carol Dyer. 3. Bob Dyer, Carol Dyer, and Mike Dyer were not related and never knew each other. Gotta go. Let me know, Bob. Ta-da.
Yeah. So the whole thing got read.
Mm-hmm.
I said, plan for decades. I've been planning it for a couple, 20 years or something, but we find out from Ian was planned since 1911. I'm just going to go down and see if we have an August Harmonic Convergence Mike Dyer show. That would be 1987. It has to be August 5th. So let's listen to the August 5th show to see if we do the Bob Virgins thing.
Program by Bob. The funny thing about Bob, Bob was stinky and did not take a bath. He smelled. A dog smelled better.
All falsities, of course. None of this is true. And
nowhere near if Finnegan's awake. But there was something you were mentioning, seeing the prominence of the Subgenius book in all our local bookstores, right even by the cashiers. I mean, that's a sure sign of a cop-out right by the cashiers.
You have your wallet out. You have the image of Bob staring at you. Well, the
word of Bob.
The word of Bob.
Sold.
And you have your wallet, your credit cards there, and you could just, like a magnet.
And you have a pink at the cashier.
You feel your money just lifting out of your wallet. You reach for the book. Something draws you to
it. And it wasn't there in, say, May.
No.
It started happening in July once we'd been on the air for a couple of weeks.
The term Subgenius was virtually unknown at the time, and there are some people. We get some phone calls from some devotees who we try to save over the phone.
Yes, they're guided by reference to any of the book.
Too late, but
well, that reminds me, there's been a lot of pink action and anti-Bob action at the radio station.
Let's talk about that. I'm a little concerned about my fellow programmers.
Yes.
I know a few have been interested in what we're doing, and...
Yes, but they want the tapes. They want the address to get the tapes. They miss the whole point.
Exactly.
They don't ask to have me on the air. I mean, to have me on the air is the essence of the church, and keep me on as much as possible. But no, they want... It's amazing the way the conspiracy can control the pink forces and mobilize them immediately when I surface.
Mm-hmm. Of course, an exception to that is the programmer who follows us at 6 o'clock, and that is Tom Given. And Tom, in fact, has been saved by the Church of the Subgenius by...
I think he should testify.
Perhaps someday we'll have Tom on for a testimonial, maybe a future date.
And the reason he was saved is that he wanted to get the book, and he wanted an address, yes, with a tape address. But in the meantime, his immediate contact with me moved him past that digression immediately, and now he's a happy guy.
Oh, thank goodness that we just jumped over that hurdle.
He's got a lovely family.
He's got a lovely child, and he has, I think he's improved both physically and mentally in the past few weeks.
He certainly has.
He's lost many years. Let's talk a little bit more about that. I think about the pinks and the inflection of the pinks in the radio station.
Yeah, I'm not leaving your segment, Mike.
No.
I mean, unless they act properly. You've got me. I'm working with you. Any of these other guys try to co-op us with these ridiculous tapes with no understanding of Finnegan's Wake, then we will deal with the matter properly.
Well, we'll keep it going, and I'll try to remain my objectivity for as long as I can.
I know it's hard because they're working on you.
Sometimes I break. Sometimes I feel, but I'm strong.
That wet underwear, ooh.
Any more comments about the election before we break today? The election?
Not the public election. That's not an election. The secret campaign to put me into the Council of Ten, which is necessary to prepare us for the Exodus arrival sometime over the imminent eon.
Mm-hmm.
Just wait for that phone number.
Okay. We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Praise Bob.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was August 5th, 1987. 11, 12 days before the harmonic Bob Virgins. So I don't seem to have mentioned it, though it is a very short tape. Maybe it didn't get recorded. You have anything to say, Sarah, so far? That was pretty funny.
It was great, yeah, because considering it would have been triggery, but then the neurolinguistic pattern of it is just like, so you just put the KY jelly on it, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah, I've been on June 17th is when I started. Then I'm on July 1st. And then July 15th, then July 22nd, so 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's the fifth show. We're just now starting to be noticed. And I say other people are starting to ask me to be on their show, and I say I'm not going to leave Mike. I was only going to be a guest one day. Now here I'm on the fifth show, and it looks like Mike's keen on it now. He wants to keep it going. So let's listen to the next one, August 19th, right after Harmonic Convergence, see what's said there. One little more segment here.
It's 5:30, and as you know, that means the return of J.R. Bob Dobbs, the Church of the Subgenius. We continue this week with Mr. Dobbs and his rhetoric, perhaps more spitting, his explanation of his position of the Church. We continue also with Media Barrage Tape number 5, Bob Attack, and it comes up right after movie time. To an exquisite taste in music. Welcome back to CKLN 88.1 in Toronto, the only station, as far as I know, in the city that, well, has touched upon Subgenius. Before I go, hold on, before we go on, Mr. Dobbs, I've given away all 4 pair of tickets for the Varoshi Fame show, so, maybe they'll be giving away more tickets later, so, but that's why you're calling. The red light is the ominous red light. Everything's okay. Okay, welcome back. Now it is 5:32. We are a little bit late. I'm sorry, but
what is that? Goon? I've heard that all day long. Did you hear that?
You just hit the microphone, I think.
No, maybe the desk did.
Does that sound like? Yeah.
Okay.
Great noises. It's.
I thought it was on Newswave a lot.
Oh, really?
I thought of something inside the mic.
Well.
Okay, it's very sensitive.
Sorry, yeah.
5:32.
Welcome back to this edition of the Church of the Subgenius. And welcome back, J.R. Bob Dobbs. Well, last week you went into something of a trance. You were communicating with forces that perhaps some of our listeners weren't familiar with. And how are you going to follow that up this week?
Well, always something dropping in my lap. You weren't here the week that Mikhail Gorbachev sent me a telegram. I don't think that was Mike Hansen. Well, his arch rival, and I guess enemy, got jealous and wanted some advice, so he sent me a telegram. See? Oh. It's just when that moves slightly. I see. So this man who sent me the telegram is, of course, Lyndon LaRouche. Now, LaRouche has asked me to bear sympathy on his situation, which is that he's running for president after Labor Day, be campaigning actively in the United States, and has to appear in court at the same time. Interesting situation for Mr. LaRouche. But he says he has a feeling he'd like to have a better understanding of process pattern recognition while he goes on campaigning. So I thought I'd elaborate on that. Maybe the particular themes we talked about last week, like the harmonic Bob Virgins, we can do later. But immediately, Mr. LaRouche, the aspects for understanding process pattern recognition is that when Bob knowledge is communicated, it begins with an extension of itself, an expression, a statement, or an apparatus. That amplifies a mood or apparatus, hard or soft, or situation. Now, that becomes an environment for a moment or so, however long it lasts. The process is that it immediately obsolesces, this is phase 2, the previous mood, apparatus, hard or soft, situation that preceded it. Now, the discovery, post-Hegelian discovery of Bob knowledge, is that there's not a dialectic between what was obsolescent and what is now prominent. Included in that is the retrieval aspect. Something that was obsolesced before these two situations, and before that was a situation in itself, in extension, that, which was pushed aside, is retrieved. And it usually has the characteristics of the situation, statement, hard or soft, that I have just made. But it's not exactly the same. It is brought back. Now, when this process those first three phases are in interaction with each other, the extension, the obsolescence, and the retrieval. They then push into their opposite. The first phase pushes into its opposite characteristics. And that is the key to Bob knowledge and the process of his communication, these four phases. Now, they either happen sequentially or simultaneously, depending on how long you're looking or experiencing the situation. Depends on the time frame. So, Mr. LaRouche, when you're communicating to the public, remember that process. You'll be extending a statement, a situation. You'll be obsoleting a previous situation, but retrieving other things at the same time, and then it will flip into something that is opposite in characteristics. That is the key to process pattern recognition and the key to the Book of the Subgenius before it was printed. And it's getting awful hard for me to, as a personal note, to put up listening to these tapes because I enjoy anger as much as anybody else, but it's just getting very frustrating to hear.
Trying for you.
To hear what Stang did. Really, I mean, he had an opportunity.
But I think it's important to look at these tapes in their historical context, and, you know, like any good, balanced person should be able to view both the right and the wrong, and then create his or her own picture of what he has seen or taken in, he or she has taken in.
But that's the principle of the user's content. That's obvious. That's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
The user is the content. But the point is to understand that process and not identify with either response you have.
Yeah. Well, I have empathy with you, but I think it's important that we do run these tapes.
Yes,
And certainly for the public, I think for the listening audience, that they should get the taste of the Subgenius, according to Stang.
Well, they are my archives.
Sure.
They are wrongly edited, but at least the archives
you're
are being...
It's very brave of you. You've been quite strong.
Well, let's move on.
Move right on to the tape. Okay, so we're going to continue this week with the Bob Attack Media Barrage. We'll be back before 6 o'clock. Okay.
Sorry.
Welcome back to CKLN FM 88.1 in Toronto.
I had to stop there. That song, that last bit of my feelings.
A nice place to end, actually, on this week's...
This week, the reason we have a little time here to say something. The Harmonic Bob version was an incredible success. Unbelievable.
Tell us about it. I was up north, and I think I missed a good part of the harmonica convergence. Why don't you tell us?
Well, you missed the convergence, but you didn't miss the Bob versions. I mean, those virgins, they were little bobbies.
I saw signs. I felt something. Perhaps you could explain what exactly happened.
Did you hear anything? Yes. You saw, or are you visually biased?
No. There was a sound, a tone.
Yes, yes.
Well, describe it to me. What was it, the Bob virgins?
That was the consonance with the spit rant that I made on Wednesday, last Wednesday.
Yeah.
Michael McGee might be listening. Anyways... The thing is, I'm in such an incredible afterglow that I was willing to listen to a few more minutes of the tape today because I don't have much to say other than the excess, as was alluded to earlier by Follow Drummond in that beautiful song, which featured me on guitar and female falsetto.
Mm.
Right? That was beautiful.
Inspiring.
It was, oh, boy, that was real me talking. That was me. That was actual studio stuff from about 22 years ago. And it was beautiful.
It's ageless.
Now, look, I didn't hit the mic. You hear, ping, you hear that? I don't know how that... It must come from the table.
Don't question it, Bob.
Yeah.
Okay. Let it happen.
It's nice. Okay.
Tone.
Now, what I want to say is the reason we're on the air is that the next day is moving up to any point in the next few months. And that's why I have to get into the Secret Council 10 to protect us from the... I don't like to think about it, but, you know, to protect us. And so we want the listeners to be not necessarily donating money or anything or writing up. It's too late for that. There's no more money left. Hot money rules. The point is to be listening every Wednesday to what may be the time and moment when process pattern recognition arrives and releases the phone number, which you are to call and get me in there. And after this weekend, I think we can do it.
Okay. All right. I'd like to talk about hot money next week, actually.
We will.
All right. Thank you very much, J.R. Bob Dobbs, for returning once again this week for our session of the Church of the Subgenius. My name is Mike Dyer, and we will be back next Wednesday, 5:30.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
World watchers, entrepreneurs, represent the epitome of organized crime, but on an international scale.
Hey, Russell.
they seek to take over whole nations. They do not hesitate to murder and destroy anyone or anything that gets in their way. G. Gordon Liddy is running training camps for terrorists. Called Barbie working for the United States, sending arms to Israel.
Every other Sunday,
America fear about the spread of communism through Central America led to considerable activity on the continent by the CIA, an American volunteer group that would kill 10,000 American citizens who were political left or fighting fascism. And of course, John Singlau is now with the World Anti-Communist League in the Philippines, trying to overthrow Corazon Aquino.
World Watchers with me, Russell, every other Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on CKLN, your only news alternative.
Oh, that's neat. There was a Made Russell commercial. Oh, look, yeah. Hey, Shannon.
Hey, Bob.
Now, that's incredible. What year did Mr. McDonald die? I kind of remember that name. I remember when this guy died in your lap, as I think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I think it was 82, but it might have been 83. I think it was 82. It was May 20th or 21st, something like that, the one-year anniversary that my mom died. Yeah, that's why
that
it was
now.
Really interesting. It was a week before that I met Bukowski on the street in Toronto. I was just going for a walk, and Mr. McDonald and I, we bumped into each other, and he introduced me to Bukowski. Actually, Mr. McDonald was so funny. Instead of introducing him to me as, you know, Shannon, I'd like to introduce you to this world-renowned poet, my friend, Charles Bukowski, he did it the other way. He said, Charles, I want to introduce you to one of my favorite students of all time. And he was introducing me to Charles Bukowski. So, then I went straight from meeting him to the library to look up his poems. And I found a poem that I really liked. And then the next week in class, I was reciting the poem because it was on the anniversary of my mom's death. The poem was about death and dying. Here I was reciting it, and the whole room was really quiet. We were sitting in a circle, and I was sitting beside Mr. McDonald, and after I finished reciting it, I was waiting for him to say something, and he didn't say anything. And he was very dramatic, Mr. McDonald, and I didn't want to interrupt his dramatic silence, so I was just kind of like waiting, and I was looking around, is anyone else finding this really weird that he's taking so long to respond to my poem? And then all of a sudden, I noticed that his skin was turning like blue and then black, and then I was like, oh my God, like something weird is happening. And then he just bolted out of his chair onto the floor and was having a massive heart attack right there in the classroom.
Does he wiggle during a heart attack?
No, he didn't. Just like I said, he bolted out of the desk onto the floor. His skin turned black. It was really weird because then the whole class went into pandemonium, and then Paul, my brother, he flies in the room. So he was in another classroom at the time, but somebody had started yelling in the halls, Mr. McDonald's having a heart attack. So I was sort of like mopping his brow, thinking, you know, maybe I could help him come too. And then my brother flies in, and he starts doing CPR.
How did Paul know that, your twin brother?
A few months earlier, Paul had taken CPR, you know, because our mom died of a heart attack, so he felt like he should learn how to do that.
Yeah.
And so he did. And he came in, he tried to help, and then a few other people tried to help, but it was too late. He was gone.
So then the emergency comes eventually.
Yeah.
And now you start crying.
Well, yeah, it was just a major freak out in the whole school, and Mr. McDonald and I were really kind of good friends, and so it was, yeah, it was really dramatic on the one-year anniversary of my mom's death. She died of a heart attack. We were talking about death. That was what my poem was about. It was by Charles Bukowski, his good friend, who he introduced me to, like, days before, so it was just totally extremely synchronistic and wild.
Now, I know that we didn't know each other enough. Your mother dies on May 21st, is that what you're saying?
May 20th.
And then you meet Carolyn by the middle of June or something, right?
Right.
Yeah, a few weeks later, your teacher decided you should talk to Carolyn. She was a patient of Carolyn.
Right.
I can see by, you know, a year later, you have no idea what I'm involved in. I can totally understand
right.
why you would never think I'd be connected to Bukowski. You did not know me enough at that point, right?
That's right.
We only slowly got to know each other.
I wasn't being spiteful or whatever you said earlier.
No. Someone else said
it
that.
It just never came up. It never came up.
That's right. I mean, it is incredible now. I mean, Bukowski's
yeah.
important. And to think that all that happened around Bukowski, you're reading his poem. I think this is about me again, as everything always ends up, right?
Of course.
Which means I killed your mother.
Well, you killed Mr. McDonald, I guess. I don't know. But,
how dare he come to Toronto and not introduce Bukowski to me? How dare he? It's just the same as whatever else person.
Here you had been wanting to meet Bukowski, and then I get introduced to him.
No, I met Bukowski in 76.
Oh, you met him? Oh, yeah, that's right. You met him before.
Yeah.
That's right. I didn't even
yeah.
know all that. Yeah.
I didn't really know Paul till about a year later. You know, Paul
right.
didn't want to be a foster son or anything. It was all kind of vague the first year.
You didn't want to be a foster father. That's what it was.
That's right. Yeah. So I was probably keeping my distance. Paul didn't even come around. He might have
yeah.
came after he learned CPR in the summer of '82. He started to talk to us or something. But I remember you when Bob Marshall made his first broadcast on CKLM, you and Carolyn, we all gathered around and listened to it. It was August 84. You were very impressed with Bob Marshall's voice and this and that. I remember your excitement. I would say you started to notice me in your teenage mind then because you knew I was involved with the radio scene, and that probably impressed you. I think that's when you started asking me about what the hell are you about? What do you do or something?
No,
I don't.
It was when ever I would come over, you'd be like peeking from the blinds. That's what it was.
Where would you be?
I would be coming over, and you would never come to the door, but you would be peeking from the blinds upstairs when I would come over to see Carolyn.
So I didn't talk to you much at the first?
No, not at first.
Do you recall when you first started to have an interaction with me, that new memory? So, okay, now I'm talking to this guy. He's
yes.
not spying on me. What's your first yeah. memory of our talking, communicating?
When I met Carolyn, you know, I was so overwhelmed by her kindness, her generosity, her competency, her intuitiveness. Like, I was just so blown away by her. And then when I met you, I thought, wow, like, he's so alive and so neat and so interesting. And then it was like, wow, like, she's so amazing. Like, she has it all. She has this practice. She has her autonomy because she was so independent of you. And then she also has this really cool husband. And then you and I started getting into a lot of talks, and you told me school makes you dumb, and you know, we'd get into our intellectual talks, and
yeah.
Carolyn would go to bed and we would still be up talking, and it was just a really great rapport.
So you don't have any memory of a particular topic? And the school one, yes, you definitely remember that one. That was a shock
yeah.
for you. But
yeah.
And you were still in high
How
school.
How dare you
so.
Say that? I was thinking, like, why would a responsible husband of a doctor tell a teenager who's just been orphaned that school makes you dumb, don't worry about school? Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting point of view. So, yeah, I thought you were really, really, like, renegade. I knew that.
Other than that, do you remember hearing Mae Brussels tapes, Dr. Beter tapes?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Hey, did you knew about the Pentagon attack on Russia on September 1782 because you and your friend were hugging and nervous all day, remember? You were quivering.
Oh, gosh.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes. We were at school and we thought it was going to be the last days, you know, the last
yeah,
day
yeah.
even. That's right. And I told her, come on, I'm going over to, you know, Carolyn and Bob's. That's where I'm going to spend my last moments. And that was Anna. And so I convinced her to not go back to her family because she didn't find her family very warm and loving anyway. So she wanted to come with me.
And I walked into the house in the afternoon there on the first floor in Carolyn's office. I saw you and Anna huddling in one of the side rooms on the black table.
Oh my
yes,
God,
and you
that's
were
so funny
and
that you
totally
remember
nervous.
That.
I remember that exactly. And so what happened in the conversation? Did I tell you to calm down or what?
No, you probably said, I don't know, you made a joke, made me laugh, and it seemed like everything was somehow going to be all right. That's what I remember, that I felt happy. I felt happy
yeah.
for a change.
it got relieved, and we waited out the rest of the day, and nothing happened. Isn't this funny? Talking about what happened on September 17th, 1982.
Yeah.
Here's what I wanted to say. If I told you about Beter in September 82, that means within a year I was telling you stuff. So that gives an idea that I was talking to you about things.
By
the time McDonald died.
After I met you. Yeah. It was pretty soon after I met you.
You know, you would be amazed at the coincidence. You have to understand that I might be a little detached at the time because this was always happening around me, these kind of synchronicities. Like, oh, okay, yeah, that's any foster daughter of mine is going to have their favorite teacher drop dead while with Bukowski, see?
Oh, gosh.
McDonald must have organized a poetry reading for him. And then Bukowski was around for the funeral. Did you speak to him at the funeral? Or? Oh, he spoke. You and he spoke.
There was a lot of people who spoke, or a few people, anyway. And I know I was asked to speak. He was asked to speak, a few other people. But, no, I didn't really socialize. I was kind of out of it a little bit. I just found funerals. It was just too much, you know.
Right.
It was right after my mom died, and then he died, and then the circumstances around it, and just didn't really
find it social. If you knew, somehow you took, because his name came up, and I told you that I used to have sex talks with him on the phone in 1978, 79, I think that would have been too much for you, that kind of synchronicity.
Yeah, no, you didn't tell me that. I don't know, because you used to pretty much tell me anything and everything, but
right. No,
I don't. That did not come up, definitely.
Well, when did you encounter Prince's manager?
I think 83.
Right, that one, his movie came out, his album, that was his big year, his beginning
Purple
year.
Rain, and I was such a big fan of his, and I wanted to, when he was coming to Toronto, the tour sold out in like half an hour or an hour or something. I really wanted to go, and I figured out, well, if I can't get tickets, I know Carolyn knows everybody, there's got to be a connection. So I just said to her, you know, who do you know who could possibly be 6 degrees of separation to Prince? Like, I've got to go see this. And so she knew, I forget the lady's name now, who was part of CPI Concert Production International. She was a caterer for CPI, and so if I agreed to work for her for a week prior for free, I would be able to be backstage for the Prince concert. So I did, and I was, and I met John Perrant, who was the tour coordinator. He was also a very interesting man. He was a speechwriter for Martin Luther King. The first night that he met me, he became a little enamored, and anyway, he gave me a job and wanted me to be on the tour, so I basically did, and I just left the catering job and went on the tour, and of course, Carolyn was very angry and upset, and you were like, no, this is fun. Have fun. Go for it. And Carolyn thought I was being very irresponsible, which I was. Anyway, I learned my lesson. I learned my lesson because he was a bit of a lech, and then he just wanted to have a relationship with me, and I was so young. I was so young, and he was like 38 or 40, and I said, no, I don't want anything to do with you. And then I got really kind of enamored with Benny Rietveld, who now is the lead guitarist for Santana. Benny and I kind of were getting to know each other. And then John, because he was the guitarist for Sheila E., and she was the opening act for Prince. But then I got kicked off the tour because John Perrant got jealous of me and Benny. So that's what happened.
Now, Shannon, this reminds me of a very interesting experience you had around that time. It might be connected to this. Didn't you have a friend in Chicago you'd go visit?
I'm not going to go into that.
Was that meeting connected to Prince?
No.
Is that the next year?
I don't know. I'm not good with time, but yeah. But I did go to Chicago on the Prince tour, but that's not how I met him.
Was that guy you met originally, you met him in Toronto?
Yes.
Did you meet him? Yes, and then he ended up in Chicago and you went there. Well, you have to hand it to you. You were ready to do the jet set lifestyle as soon as possible if it worked.
Well, yeah, I guess. I was just kind of following my adventurous spirit, I guess. I think it was more about people than the lifestyle.
It was people. You were into keen on people. That's what Garrett used to say about me. Bob, you're very keen on people.